Welcome to the Booktopia podcast.
I'm Cheryl Stirling, and I'm lucky enough to be here today with the amazing Amy Kaufman and Jake Stock, co-authors of Illuminate.
Hi.
Hello.
So, guys, you've really written a very creative and imaginative book here. Can we kick things off by talking about the way you chose to tell this story? Because it's quite unusual. It's not your average epistolary novel, and I'm not sure if I said that right, but...
That's okay. Epistolatory. Jay had to look that word up.
I think it's epistolary.
Epistolary, that sounds right.
But yeah, I had to Google it.
Please email Booktopia and tell us how you say that word. It's such a reader problem, though, that you know all
you've
these words.
You've read the words,
you
know what it means, but you can't say
it. You can't say it. Dude, I thought Segway was pronounced Sieg until I was like 23.
I used to spell Segway with W-A-Y on the end of it, so it was Segway Way. True story. Author.
I used to think the word chagrin was pronounced chagrin. Oh. And said it that way
yeah,
for
I
many
said it,
years
I said
before
it
I scripted it.
Well, I mean, yeah, English man. What's with that?
But Illuminate.
Yeah, the question was how do we start writing? Why do we write it this way?
Yeah, like explain a bit, because it's a collection of emails and...
Yeah, and instant messages, yeah. Security footage, comic strips, schematics, like no normal narrative chapters. Everything's alternate format.
Yeah.
So the very first idea we had was around writing an email novel. And kind of hilariously, that came out of an anxiety dream that I had, that because we were already friends and I dreamed that we were writing this book together and that I couldn't remember what the book was about in the dream. That was the anxiety part. So I spent the whole dream trying to sound Jay out like, so... Forget what I think. If you were to describe this chapter, how would you describe it? Like trying to find out what the plot was, which I never did. And so when I saw him next, like I told him this and we like kind of laughed and then went, hang on, wait a minute. Book, hey. But so we started out with kind of this idea of going with emails and then it expanded. So
yeah, it was, we didn't know what the book was going to be about. We knew it was going to be a boy and a girl. And they were talking via email, and that was it. That was where we started. We didn't even know it was going to be sci-fi at that point. And so then we just started bouncing around ideas. Well, why don't these two actually walk up and have a face-to-face conversation, like in a regular book? So we had to insert some barrier between them, and that ended up, after a long and involved conversation, being the fact that they were on two different spaceships, and if they tried to have a face-to-face conversation, they would asphyxiate in the void of space. And from that point, we... very quickly branched out from emails and started talking about instant messengers and then involving schematics of the ships. And if we delved further into, you know, the futuristic internet, we could have Wikipedia-esque type pages. So
Unipedia, right? Is that what you
Unipedia,
call it?
Yeah. Unipedia. We're assured it is different enough that we won't get sued. Fine.
Fingers crossed.
That was a cool touch. The book is full of cool little touches.
Yeah. Well, I think all of the different... types of formatting offer different opportunities to tell the story in different ways. Because if the two characters are writing an email to each other, one of them is not going to say, you know, hey, so as you know, we've been on the run now for 6 months and, you know, things are looking grim for us. Because you don't say that in a conversation where both people already know that as a fact. Mm. So, you know, the emails and the IMs were great for getting really personal. And then if you wanted to share some information, you might go for a press release or a security document or... if you wanted to show the ship they were on, you might get the blueprints done. We got our own spaceship designer, which was by far...
so cool.
You got to be up, right up there on like a podium finisher for career moments.
I thought you guys just must know a lot about spaceships. No.
Basically, we describe them. He does concept drawings. We go,
that one,
but like with more guns on the back in case someone chases them. And then he draws schematics. He's incredible.
Wow.
But so it turned out that all of the different formats allowed us to tell different parts of the story.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was when we stumbled across the idea of the artificial intelligence being a narrator as well that really opened up into, I guess, the stranger formatted pages, you know, when the dogfights in space are being described typographically as well as narratively.
That was so effective.
Oh, cool.
It was such a like sense of action that you don't get.
Yeah, like we want people to have to, you know, I mean, there's one scene that's a barrel roll where you literally have to turn the book in your hands 360 degrees to read what he does. So we wanted people to have to handle the book differently.
That would have been made a lot more sense than just trying to read it, which is, I don't think I tilting
your head to the side.
360 degrees.
I think that was
doing the dog head tilt.
I wasn't really thinking outside the box there. One part that I really liked along the lines of the visual aspects that you did in the book was you had a character bouncing along the top of the spaceship, and you like wrote the words across the sky, and it was just like really effective. I really felt like it's a different sort of reading experience. And
I mean, and it was very much meant to be. Like, the idea was that the story needed to stand up regardless. Like, that if I was sitting down for a coffee with you and telling you the story and saying, so, there's this boy and this girl, and it would need to be a story that would keep you sucked in the whole way. Because the risk when you do anything alternate format is that it just goes gimmicky. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to make sure the story itself stood up. But we also wanted to make sure that the format added something completely new to the story and added new layers and added new ways of understanding it, so that it wasn't just there to look good. It was there to change the way you experience it.
Yeah. A thing that I found reading the book is that, you know, every character here, no matter how peripheral they are, really jumps off the page because you get to read their own words in an email from them, or which means that, you know, when you have character deaths, of which there are a fair amount in this book, you feel it that much more strongly. Is that something you set out to do, or did it sort of, like, how do you do it?
Dialogue's a really good shortcut into character motivation and character depth, particularly if you're watching someone who doesn't think they're being watched. Like, when Katie's writing her journal, she writes that for herself. She's not writing expecting anyone else will ever read it. Like, she doesn't expect to get out of the story alive. So when you're in a private moment talking only to yourself, that's about as pure you as you can ever be. But even in day-to-day conversations, you know, when you're avoiding those, as you know, gym moments and still trying to describe what's happening on board the ship, the dialogue gets really to the heart of the matter, the heart of the characters, the heart of the story, the way they think. You know, watching two guys joke around and make, you know, inappropriate
frat boy jokes.
Frat boy humor. Yeah.
Comments
frat boy
about
humor is a good
each
way
other's
to...
sisters.
I mean, I mean, that's the way guys talk, but they don't talk about that kind of thing in public. They talk about it when they're alone with their friends and don't think anyone else is watching. So you're really seeing a kind of hidden and intimate side of these characters, and I think that's a real shortcut to knowing who they are and what they want.
Yeah, and it was about for each character. I mean, they are there to advance the action or deliver some information, or, like, everyone's got a job on the page. But it was about also asking yourself, what else is happening for this person? If I just stop and go into this person's point of view, how are they experiencing the story?
Yeah.
So, you know, you get a doctor who writes a long list of descriptions as this plague starts to mutate and get worse and worse through the story. We have her providing information to her ship's captain about what's happening, and then you just get a little PS down the bottom, you know, I really miss you, do you think we can catch up tonight? And suddenly she's a person. She's not just, you know, a random white coat delivering information. She's a person with, you know, a love life and friends, and probably, and then by extension, because our brains do this, if you give people a seed, our brains automatically fill in so much information. Like, that's why we make judgments about people. The moment we meet people, we look at how they're dressed or what they look like or what they're doing or what they've just said, and we immediately construct a massive picture of them based on one piece of information. And often that picture's not true, but, you know, first impressions are sort of considered so important for a reason. And if you just give that one seed about a character, the reader constructs this whole thing for them, yeah.
We're also, I think, deliberately vague in describing people and their physicality. I mean, not only there's not really that much opportunity to do that given the nature of the book, but also we left people intentionally physically vague so the reader could kind of put their own impressions on what they look like. Because, like Amy said, you see someone, you make a judgment about who they are and what they are. Whereas if you're just listening to their voice, you get a clearer impression of who they are and can imprint your own ideas and visuals on top of that.
Like, readers imagine the characters to be different races, different genders, all kinds of stuff.
It's so funny that you say this, because it's only now that I realised that there was no description really of anyone.
Katie has
pink hair. Yeah, that's it.
And she's short.
And blue eyes.
And Ezra is tall.
Yeah, with brown eyes.
And that's kind of it.
But everyone is so vividly drawn that mm-hmm. I can see them in my mind. But that's just my weird version.
But it's been really interesting speaking to readers early on and finding out how they visualise those characters. Like Amy said, we've had people visualise them different races. And
that's so cool.
Yeah, it's been really cool.
Yeah. I was listening to the audiobook the other day and one character came on and I said to my husband, oh, that was meant to be a woman. And he said, really? I read it as a guy. So, you know, there are...
That's really cool.
Yeah.
And to be so, to have a medium of storytelling that allows you to be that vague about physicality, but still draw these characters to the extent that they feel so real.
I think what it comes down to is that readers are really smart, and they're not always given credit for that. Often, you know, there's this urge to give people heaps and heaps and heaps of detail as if they're not going to work it out themselves. But actually, readers have fabulous imaginations and they're clever and they're prepared to put together clues and they're prepared to imagine things for you.
Mm.
So I think leaving those gaps actually allows them to make the story richer.
It's especially true of YA, I think, that it gets overwritten a bit.
I think there's an encouragement to do it.
Yeah.
And I think that the best novels, whether they're YA or adult, have these places where you can insert yourself and where you can put your own twist on the way you imagine it.
Yeah.
And that was kind of our intent putting it together. We wanted you to feel, as the reader, like you were part of this mystery, like you were reading this secret file and putting together, what happened on board these ships. Yeah. So you're not just a passive passenger to the story. You're part of solving the puzzle.
Oh, 100%. It's a really interactive book. Like, as interactive as a book with just paper pages can be. So having co-written this book, and it just seems to be a trend that's starting up at the moment, especially in YA, which I firmly believe YA sort of sets the tone for trends.
Like, wow, all the cool kids are in
YA. If it's happening in YA and gaining popularity in YA, then it's gonna spread. And I think co-authoring is like a thing that's happening more now than ever before.
Yeah.
What is it you think, like... is it a really different experience than writing alone, or is it?
It is really
easier,
different.
More difficult.
Oh, it's better. It's heaps better. I think. Look, I mean, I can imagine it could be a disaster if you had the wrong people. I think you have to choose really carefully. But we just have a blast. We just love it.
It's the single most fun I've ever had writing a book. Like, this is the fourth book I've put out, and when you're writing a book by yourself. I am sure every author has come across this situation. You're sitting there at 2 o'clock in the morning and staring at that flashing cursor and you have no one and nothing to kind of turn to. And it's not like you can even send off the work to a beta reader or a crit partner unless you've got a certain percentage of words on the page, you know. So sometimes it's just you and that flashing cursor and you feel like the loneliest person on the planet.
And I think most authors have this experience where the first third of the book, they're like, yeah, it's coming together. Yeah, I'm good at this. That's right. I know how to write.
Bungy middle.
Yeah, and then you hit about the one third mark and this it just hits this patch of, I don't know what I'm doing. This is a terrible story. It's terribly written. I need to move to Brazil. Like, it's just... And that doesn't happen when you're co-authoring. Because
you've got someone at the other end of GChat that you can bounce ideas off straight away. And you're getting immediate feedback in terms of your ideas. You don't have to commit 10,000 words before you realise that you've taken a wrong turn.
Yeah, and I think as well, ideally what you do is you pick someone to write with whose writing you respect enormously, who you really think knows how to write, and ideally who complements the way you write. So, you know, I really love, like, Jay's really good at going dark and intense and making you terrified that the characters are not going to make it out. And I think one of the reasons you're terrified of that is you know he's not afraid to do it. You know that it's an actual...
Because it's happened several times already, I'm sorry, and you're geared up for it.
Yeah, like, it's a genuine risk. I had a very balanced
childhood.
Yeah, there's no explaining how he grew up. But, you know, you pick someone who you love their writing and you love what they do and you know that they do things well that you'd love to do well. And it means that if both of you were tugging like that, then, you know, in all kinds of different directions, but in a good way, not in a having a fight about it way, you get your mind opened up to things you might not have thought about doing otherwise.
Definitely. You get your perceptions challenged almost on a daily basis if you pick the right partner. And you work to each other's strengths. And even if you do come to blows, and Amy and I haven't had an argument yet. When we do have a fight, I'm sure it's going to be a doozy over something completely ridiculous.
Yeah. It'll be copy edits, and it'll be like, that comma stays there.
On this hill, I shall die. But yeah, when you do come to a disagreement, you know that no matter what your own personal opinion is, the other person's disagreeing with you because they want the book to be the best it can possibly be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's not an attack on ego.
Definitely
It's
not.
You standing side by side, looking at the book together, talking about ways you can make it better. And when you've got that idea, it becomes really easy to solve the problem. It becomes, you know, for instance, I'm wanting to do one thing and Jay's wanting to do another. We can actually just sit down and go, okay, let's work out why our instincts are to do those things. And we will work out, okay, so my instinct is, I think we need to kick up the action because it's been a bit quiet. And Jay's instinct is, I think we need to spend a moment internally with this character because all this major stuff has happened and we haven't checked in with her yet. So we should do that. So then the question becomes, okay, how do we combine both of those things? Perhaps we can, you know, have the character have to work through something or climb something that is very action intensive, but have pauses in it that require the character to reflect, you know, like, and it makes it stronger. It's often the other person's ideas are like that little bit of grit that gets in the oyster that makes the pearl, you know, that makes something you never would have thought of by yourself.
So if there was one thing each of you could say you learnt from the other during the process of writing this book, what would it be?
Good question.
It's
going to be silence now. We can edit the silence out, right?
We can put thinking music in. Do, 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 do.
This is where it all comes undone. I don't learn anything from him. I don't even know. Yeah, they made us come here. I'm sure I can't even do that with a straight face. I think one of the things that Jay does that I really, really admire that I've been like working on bringing into my own writing, and I don't always succeed, but I try very hard to do, is that you need to not be afraid to do the terrible thing. That you can't just threaten consequences over and over again. You need to be willing to literally kill your darlings. And usually when we say that, we mean edit out, you know, some part of the book that you loved. But I mean, literally, you know, you need to be unafraid to either literally kill characters or to go to very emotionally raw places with your characters. And I think he's really unflinching about doing that. And I really admire it. And I've been trying very hard to bring that to my writing. And occasionally I'll have an idea. Like there's one part of Illuminae where I had the idea, but I knew that he was going to write it better than I was, so I, you know, handed that section over to him and was like, here's the idea, make it work. And he did spectacularly. But yeah, I think that's been a really, I was going to say fun, but mostly traumatic learning experience for me, because I'm fundamentally a bit of a Pollyanna and I'm always like, I'm so sorry as I'm killing them. But I'm better at doing it now.
Some really amazing characters were lost.
They were in the making of this book. And I wept.
We named a lot of them after people we know as well.
Mm. Oh, wow.
Out of love, though. Not out of,
yeah.
Not out of any, you know, idea that we want them gone. I think the thing that I've learned from Amy that's probably affected my writing the most is the power that can lie in quiet moments, moments of reflection, and simple moments as well, I guess. Amy has a real knack of dropping in, it can be like a 3 or 4 word sentence that just kicks me in the stomach. And I tend to be, I guess, verbose, flamboyant the way I write. I like to write big and I like to write loud, and it comes back to what we were saying before about picking a partner that plays to your weaknesses rather than your strengths. Amy is a writer who can very quickly and very succinctly sum up a moment or a feeling or a motivation in, like I say, a 3 or 4 word sentence that just kind of gets right to the heart of things. So watching Amy do that has made me very conscious of my inability to do that. And so yeah, I've been trying to work on that now. But yeah, she's amazing. And a lot of the instant messenger conversations that we wrote in the book, we ad-libbed. Like we would sit down and say, okay, Katie and Ezra need to have a romantic moment here. We wouldn't know what they were going to talk about. We wouldn't know how it was going to begin. We just noted to know by the end of these three pages, they have a sweet moment so the reader can kind of get to know them and their relationship better. But other than that, we would go into those totally blind. We would just ad-lib those conversations. You know, someone would start talking, they'd start playing a riff, and the other person would pick it up and run with it. And I remember a couple of those moments where Amy would pick up on something that I had said kind of offhandedly three pages before and twist it and turn it into this perfect... There's one scene in particular, it's my favourite scene in the whole book, where she picked up this... It was an innocuous statement that I'd said three pages earlier, and she turned it into this perfect ender, like, yeah, this perfect full point to the scene that we'd written. And it, yeah, blows me away every time.
There is a high level of witty banter in this book that is...
We had so much fun writing it. I think that's the other thing is when you're... Because we were literally co-writing stuff, like going back and forth, line by line by line, you're not thinking, oh, now I must impress the other person. But, you know, it's like when you're in a really fun conversation with someone at a party and you find yourself funnier than you would usually be because you're kind of rising to the occasion.
Yeah.
And I think when you're going back and forth on stuff, you ride out of your skin a little bit to match what's going on.
Well, your answers to the questions of what you learnt from each other pretty much sum up what I love about this book so much, is that it is this big, grand, larger-than-life, totally action-packed story, which is so grounded in character. Like, really...
Yeah, it has to be a story about people.
Yeah. Which you don't... I mean, and maybe my reading experience isn't wide enough in space opera, but I kind of tend to find that that's not always the case. In TV shows, sure. Like,
yeah.
This was described as Battlestar Galactica meets 10 Things I Hate About You, which is pretty spot on. And, you know, I'm not the hugest science fiction reader, but I love science fiction movies and TV shows and stuff. And I think it's because in most of my reading, that grounded character base isn't there. Here, it's like it's a cute, adorable romance that happens to be happening
in the middle of
interstellar war.
I think that's in a way like that was sort of a lead we took from Battlestar Galactica, that has a lot of very personal moments about very, you know, quiet moments between people in between everything going terribly horribly wrong and exploding.
The characters are the lens by which this story gets told. Like they're literally telling you their story, or they're telling their friend what they're thinking, what they're feeling. So there is no kind of third-party God's eye view. Everything that happens in the book, you're seeing through the eyes of someone who had to write those words down on the page. So it's always from a human, or actually not always from a human.
Or artificial intelligence.
Slash artificial.
Well, and one of the questions in the book is around how human the artificial intelligence is, or isn't.
Because he occasionally seems... I don't even know if I'm supposed to call him a he.
Interesting,
I'm just going with
that
because Aiden is a boy's name, but like...
But Aiden is an it because Aiden is a computer.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's
very intriguing character.
A lot of readers... It's been really interesting. Some readers... Most readers pick a gender for it. Some readers call it it. We call it it because that's what it is. And I think the characters are reminded of that occasionally, that they begin to think of this computer that they talk to repeatedly as a person and as something that might act in the way a person does. And then it reminds them abruptly that it is an it, and it is not a person, and it will not always act in the way a person would.
But some readers have told us they hear it as a she, which is really interesting as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
No, I heard him as a guy.
And I think...
It as a guy.
It is, but I mean, I think this is the thing, is like, what really good science fiction does, like, if you want to kind of, you know, go back to the traditions of, you know, like, early, like, writers, like, Clark and Asimov and shows like Star Trek, is it asks big questions.
Mm-hmm.
And then it takes those big questions and pulls them down to a personal level so that you have to answer them through your own personal lens. And I think the question about the computer in this is one of the big questions. It's about, like, that it itself is wrestling with the question of what am I, and as it starts to stray from its programming, it struggles to define what it is and how it's making decisions. And, you know, I mean, the book asks a lot of questions about technology, and it asks a lot of questions about what kind of sacrifices you'd be prepared to make to share the truth about something that happened, or to save people you loved even at your own expense, and or at the expense of others maybe. So, you know, it's meant to leave you tangled up on a lot of levels and asking a lot of questions.
It has a sensational ending, which I love for being a conclusion to this story, but still so wide open for what happens
for
next.
The sequels, yeah.
So you don't have that, like, that feeling of like, God damn it, I'm left on a cliffhanger, but you still are so interested to know what happens next. Well,
yeah, we put people through a lot in this book, and I think asking them to live with a really major cliffhanger might have just been a bridge too far.
Good choice. Excellent choice. I commend that choice, because it's a satisfying read. It has a real satisfying conclusion, but you're also desperate to know what happens next. Yeah. Which leads me to my next question is, what, if anything, can you tell us about book two?
Ooh. Not a lot, but a bit.
The meta plot continues throughout the entire trilogy. So ultimately, this is a story about the fallout of the attack on the planet Carenza. And the people who survive book one appear in book two. And if they make it through book two, they'll appear in book three. But
which we're writing right now.
Trying to.
You're writing three now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay,
book two's in the can.
We're in book two.
Yeah.
Those characters make it through, if they survive, all the way to the end, and the story comes to a conclusion in book three. But you meet new characters in book two and book three, and they're in different settings. So the overall plot continues, but the focus is on a different group of people in book two.
Yeah, cool. So we can say that book two is set on a space station.
Mm-hmm.
And we can say it is going to answer some of the questions that we get asked about book one.
Like, why help never arrived?
Yeah, like, why, if the characters in book one sent out distress signals so many times over 6 months, did no one ever come to help them?
Because stuff was going down.
The answer is the authors did not forget that that was a possibility. It's that something else was happening where the help might have been sent from or where that signal might have been received. So we
deal with the fallout of that. So chronologically, they run directly after one another. So book two picks up immediately after book one leaves off.
Mm-hmm.
And we find out why help never arrived. And the plot line started in book one intersects with the plot line in book two at some point.
Yeah,
that's what I like to hear.
Yeah.
So the people that you grew to love will make
or hate.
will make appearances.
Are coming back.
And not just cameos, like they're integral
they're
to the
proper
story.
Proper character, yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
But you'll get to meet a bunch of new people that hopefully you'll like just as much.
Yeah, and I must say our editor, when we sent her book two and she responded, she sent us back an email that said, I didn't want to say it to you, but I was a little bit nervous because I wasn't sure I could love the characters as much as I did in book one, and I love them just as much, you know.
Well, considering you guys got me to love and I'm going to try this again, epistolary novel, as much as I did, and it's something that I've never, like, I've always sort of shied a little bit away from. It's not something that I've ever loved before, but now,
trust
changed
us.
My mind. Yeah,
trust
you
us.
You have my complete faith. Amy and Jay, thank you so much for coming in to talk to us about Illuminae. I think you've written something really special.
Thank you.
And I'm really looking forward to this story continuing.
So are we.
Thanks very much for having us.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.